good to go on that front.
Okay. But we anticipate that.
Do you come up?
No, wait, let me just go to my computer.
Hopefully we won't drop anyone.
And you know what, Adam, I like it, but we're going to start pretty soon, so we'll get him later.
Sure.
Okay, just
they're on the SharePoint site, too.
Oh, they are? Okay.
Okay, we're a few seconds from starting here.
What timing now?
They brought lunch.
Now, Ken is sitting right down next to us. That's good. As soon as Will is able to sit down. Nothing. I'm just waiting for Will. Okay, we're going to get started here in just a few minutes. Apologize for the delayed start. We had some technical difficulties, but it also allowed three or four more folks important to the meeting to show up. Okay, so are we actually running?
No, we have five more.
Oh, okay, good. Welcome to the third meeting of the MLPA Master Plan Science Advisory Team for the North Coast Study Region. We're going to start here with a quick introduction, so I will get started and then ask my co-chair to carry it around the corner. My name is Eric Bjorkstead. I work for National Marine Fisheries Service, and I'm also at Humboldt State University, Department of Fisheries, and I'm one of the co-chairs for the Science Advisory Team. Ron?
Ron LaValle with Mad River Biologists, co-chair.
I'm Ken Wiseman, Executive Director of the MLPA Initiative.
So complicated. I'm Phil Levin from NOAA Fisheries.
Kevin Fleming from State Parks.
Will White, University of California at Davis and Bodega Marine Lab.
Emily Sarman, UC Santa Cruz and the MLPA Initiative.
Dominique Monnier, Marine Planner with the MLPA Initiative.
Seth Miller, Science Advisory Team Assistant with the MLPA Initiative.
Don Gulley, Humboldt State University.
Craig Strong, Crescent Coastal Research.
Dominic Gregorio, State Water Board.
Steve Wirtz, California Department of Fish and Game.
Dave Henkin, Humboldt State.
Tom Mason, California Department of Fish and Game.
Becky Oda, California Department of Fish and Game.
All right, we'll try that again. I'm Mike Prawl with the California Department of Fish and Game, and we have some members on a conference line, hopefully, and so we want to use right now to test to see if we can talk to them and if they can talk to us. So anybody on that conference line? Jason, could you speak up if you're there? Oh, hold on. Someone has to do something technical to make that happen.
In the meantime, I hadn't realized Karina had stepped out. Could you introduce yourself?
Hi, Karina Nielsen, Sonoma State University.
So anybody on the conference line? Sounds like they're not, so we'll work on that and test that again in a few minutes.
Okay, there are very few adjustments to the agenda. In fact, reviewing through here, there's basically no adjustments to the agenda of any consequence, with the exception that under item 3, the modeling update has been wrapped in with item K tomorrow, so there will be no modeling update this afternoon. We'll be able to make up a little bit of time on our agenda that way. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and get directly into the meeting. Ask Ken to give us a briefing on the January 13th, 14th BRTF meeting.
Yeah, our meeting was held in Crescent City, basically an opportunity to do some touring with the task force, and we continued to set the framework and the starting foundation for our process. I think probably the highlight and something unique that we did this time was we had a tribal forum where the coalition of the tribes came together and was able to discuss issues of concern that are very much part of our process, and we're continuing to do that outreach along with the science advisory team as well as through the Blue Ribbon Task Force and in preparation for our regional stakeholder group. The regional stakeholder group will be appointed next week by the director and chair of the Blue Ribbon Task Force. So I think there were presentations on monitoring and the science of MPAs, all things, many of that were developed and continue to be improved and from other regions, but then got specific to this region here. So we're laying the foundation, and when the director and chair appoint the stakeholder group next week, that will be off and running or continuing to run.
Great, thanks. And okay, you do know that you're up. Dominique is going to give us a quick update on progress from the community external array groups.
Yes, I'm filling in for Siti Arame, who's not here due to a canceled flight. So we had about 18 community groups that indicated their intent to submit external arrays. Realistically, we're looking at probably many fewer than that actually being submitted. A lot of the community groups are working together and sharing ideas and working on single MPA arrays. So we're probably looking at between 4 and 6 arrays being submitted for evaluation by the SAT. Last week we held external array workshops, support workshops to help those groups that wanted some input, had questions to ask staff. On Monday we were in Fort Bragg, on Tuesday we were in Eureka, and on Wednesday we were in Crescent City. So we were able to reach out to a lot of those external array groups. They had a lot of questions for staff regarding some of the SAT evaluations. Specifically, there were a lot of questions on the size and spacing and habitat representation and replication evaluations, and then questions about levels of protection and how those would be used in evaluations. And so the staff answered a lot of those questions. There were also some questions about how tribal uses were going to be evaluated for the various evaluations, and also within the levels of protection. And so the staff will be compiling a list of some of those science questions that were raised from those workshops and submitting that to the various SAT work groups. Those community groups will be submitting their external MPA arrays on February 1st. That's the deadline. And then the SAT evaluation will run from February 1st to March 16th. And I believe tomorrow in the afternoon we have an agenda item that will go over that timeline. So we'll be discussing that further. That's all.
Okay, thanks, Dominique. Before we get into kind of the meat of the meeting agenda for today, I want to let everyone know that apparently we do have enough SAT members, and specifically a quorum of the the core, the master plan identified members to be able to make decisions today, and we'll hopefully be adding a few more tomorrow. That said, we don't have any material this afternoon or items this afternoon on which we will be making any decisions. There's nothing up for approval this afternoon. Most of the items for approval, I think all of them, have been pushed to tomorrow. With that in mind, the practice is to allow for public comment at any point when the SAT will be taking a vote and making a decision. There won't be really any need for that today. We will be taking general public comment tomorrow afternoon, as well as public comment in association with the various approvals that will be happening tomorrow. A reminder to members of the SAT, if you have a comment and want to get in on it, on the discussion, please put your tag up. Craig, I will do my best to see you through the cameras there. And with that, we will move on. Are there any questions or clarifications? Okay. We'll start with item C, discussing a discussion of the marine bird and mammal evaluation methods. I'm not sure whether Craig or Don is taking the lead, but please do. And could we get that presentation up?
Do I get a advance or to just say next? So this presentation is going to be in three parts, basically. I'm going to just introduce you to the cast of characters and the habitats that birds and mammals use up here, and then the second section will be our proposed evaluation criteria, and then the third part will be potential for adding some additional evaluations.
Word is from our technical people there's some difficulty with the PowerPoint, so stand by.
Okay, so I'm one of a subgroup of three of us on the marine birds and mammals. That's with Don Goley to my right and Ron LaValle across the room. Let's see. Yeah. I don't know if this has any batteries in it.
Is there a way to get some assistance with the clicker?
Okay. What am I doing?
It's heat sensitive. Right here should, first of all, it needs to be on.
Okay.
Sorry about this. There you go. And look, it's heat sensitive. It should be good. There we go. See? So this will take it forward and backwards right here. It's all heat sensitive. So get you to the beginning of your slide. I'm really sorry.
Okay. So, yeah, that was quick. some of this is going to be review. Marine birds and mammals are long-lived species, high on the trophic levels in the marine environment, characterized by having few offspring with high parental care for those few offspring, anywhere from one every 2 years to up to about four in a year. At their breeding colonies and rookeries, they are extremely sensitive to disturbance, and that will be a focus of this presentation throughout. And they feed near the top of marine food webs. Oop, the other way. There is five species of pinnipeds in these waters, four of which are ecologically dependent on the nearshore region affected by MPAs. That's stellar sea lion, harbor seal, California sea lion, and northern elephant seal. The little asterisks are for species that breed in the area. And of cetaceans, there are a great many species that use the offshore waters. The two that are ecologically dependent on the nearshore are the harbor porpoise, which breeds here, and the gray whale, which forages and migrates through the waters. For marine birds, there are 13 breeding species, nesting primarily on offshore islands, but also cliffs. Of those, the common murre, pigeon guillemot, and all three cormorant species are of particular relevance to this discussion because they nest in large colonies on the surface of islands and therefore are more susceptible to exposure to humans. Neritic non-breeding species includes a very large range of species in several groups here that concentrate in the nearshore waters affected by the MLPA. That's loons and grebes, about five species, surf and white-winged scoters, many species of gulls, two species of phalaropes, and the procellariforms, those are the shearwaters, albatross, and storm petrels. Two storm petrel species breed in this region. In the estuaries and marshes, the number of species go up to over 60. I could try shouting. Okay. Okay, so I was talking about the estuarine and marsh birds. Much higher number of species and really high seasonal numbers because though there are a few breeders, there are huge numbers of shorebirds and waterfowl that migrate through our estuaries and marshes. The shorebirds are on the shore, tide beach and tidal flat, waterfowl in the waters. Waders, that is the herons and egrets, are using marshes and shallow water. And then also a number of raptors rely on estuarine habitats and gulls and terns and the belted kingfisher. So those are the primary habitats we're looking at, as well as the open coast, rock and sand shore. There are a number of species that are reliant on rocky shoreline habitat to forage in. They specialize. Wandering tattler, black turnstone, surf birds are examples of that. And the black oyster catcher breeds here on small offshore islands. On the sandy beach, there are, again, high seasonal numbers of a lot of the same species that use estuaries. Examples are the sanderling, very common, marbled godwit, a major migrant through the area, and the snowy plover, which does nest in the region. It's also federally and state endangered. Threats to birds and mammals primarily come from human disturbance. At nesting colonies and rookeries, disturbance will cause loss of the season's production by flushing the adult animals off and exposing young to predation
and grounding and thermal stress. Chronic long-term disturbance will result in the loss of the entire colony. They'll cease to nest or use that area for breeding. In estuarine habitats, short-term to chronic loss of foraging opportunity, which is primarily why the animals are there, is for foraging. And this leads to an energetic loss of reserves for migrating and nesting. Disturbance sources include boats of all types. Basically, it's boats that access the offshore islands, hunting in estuaries, and all sorts of shoreline activities, from kite flying to horseback riding to OHV use to simply walking. Threats also come in the form of pollution. Oil spills are a major impact on seabirds. Catastrophic spills, as from a tanker or something, result in thousands to hundreds of thousands of seabirds mortality. And then there is chronic oil spills, which also occur on at a lower level, affecting seabirds. Sediment contaminants and water quality are other sources of pollutants. They're more of a factor in Southern California, but also a concern up here. Fisheries bycatch is up there. We don't have any outstanding conflicts with fisheries bycatch to these resources in our region. However, entanglement in monofilament is a factor everywhere on the coast. And entanglement in nets is of minor importance here, since most of that is already regulated. Disturbance to neritic foraging and neritic foraging hotspots means vessel traffic through foraging areas, basically, which results in loss of foraging opportunity. Oh, okay. So, Dawn is going to take on the next part and just talk about our evaluations and our approach to looking at these effects.
Thanks. So just to summarize then, there are a few benefits of marine protected areas for marine birds and mammals. There are direct effects, which includes the decreased disturbance at breeding and resting sites, and decreased human interaction, which includes bycatch, gear entanglement, and light attraction. But there are also indirect benefits by reducing competition with humans for food. You have prey. It's important because prey availability is an important factor that regulates annual breeding and population success. Oops, wrong way. So we're going to go through our evaluation, our proposed evaluation methods here. For the North Coast evaluation components, we've proposed 5 analyses to evaluate both direct and indirect. One is to protect seabird and pinniped breeding sites. We'll go into a little bit more detail about that. Two is to protect seabird roost and pinniped hollowed sites, and that those are during the periods of time when the animals aren't actively breeding. Three is protection of nearshore foraging areas. Four is protection of neritic foraging hotspots. And then 5 is protection of estuarine and coastal habitat, such as Humboldt Bay. We've built on previous MPAs and evaluation protocols from the South Coast. We've adopted some of the things that they came up with as well. We will as well evaluate proposals by site and region for species most likely to benefit. We'll include only special closures and SMRs for seabirds, and include SMCAs with regulations that maintain benefits for seabirds. Include only special closures and SMRs for marine mammals. Evaluate habitat protection for estuarine bird habitat, and evaluate habitat protection for neritic hotspots. There are a couple differences when you come up here versus in Southern California. We've proposed to evaluate the entire study region and not evaluate it by bioregion. And for a large part, that's to alleviate biases, because the north part, or the northern part of the bioregion, is more heavily influenced by large rookeries of both seabirds and marine mammals. We'll include breeding colony and rookery hotspot analysis, similar to North Central Coast study region, with some data that we'll talk about a little bit later. We don't have sea otters up here, so we won't be doing that type of analysis. I'm going to propose to do gray whale analysis, and that gray whales behave differently here on the North Coast than they do down south, and I'd like to get some input on that. And then also to include potential year-round analysis of habitat based on some year-round long-term data sets that we have here. So what I'd like to do now is just go through each of these five proposals and give you just an example of some local critters that could benefit from marine protected areas. So one is protection at breeding sites. Disturbance at breeding sites would, as Craig said, lead to predation and thermal exposure of young seabirds. It can lead to short-term and long-term abandonment of the breeding site. And example species that are the most common here would be the common murres and the two flavors of cormorants, as well as harbor seals and stellar sea lions. So how we'd analyze that is to look at the proportion of the regional breeding bird populations that are protected and look at the proportion of look at the number of rookery sites protected for each of the proposals that come in. So these are the important seabird breeding sites, and one thing to notice on the left is the sort of northern part of the region, and on the right is the southern part of the region. One thing that you should notice are that seabird breeding sites are distributed throughout the area. The ones on the right or the south are mostly guillemot and cormorant nesting areas. But you see on the in the left-hand side or the northern part around Crescent City at the very top of the slide, and then around Trinidad, you have the Castle Rock breeding area and the rocks off of Trinidad, which house very large groups of breeding seabirds, and the colors as they get redder denotes larger breeding areas or more dense breeding areas.
More species.
Important pinniped haulouts, again, it's the same graph. On the right is the southern part and on the left is the northern part. What I want to sort of point out, which is hard to see on this graph, is that there are two stellar rookeries in Northern California. One is around Cape Mendocino, and the largest in California is off of Point St. George or Crescent City. So we have endangered species that are breeding along the coast, and the rest of those groups are mostly harbor seals. So again, it's a very rich coast that's used for breeding for both pinnipeds and seabirds. So number two, our second idea was to be able to evaluate proposals based on their ability to protect roosts and haulouts. And again, this is during the non-breeding time. These roosts and haulouts during non-breeding time provide areas for the animals to rest. And obviously disturbing them is going to have them incur an energetic and thermoregulatory cost. This can lead to decreased productivity or site abandonment for birds and marine mammals. And some examples of these are California brown pelican, Brandt's cormorants, and then harbor seals and California seals, sea lions. So for analysis, again, we'll look at the proposals to see what proportion of populations in the region are protected by protecting these different roosts and haulouts. Gosh, how am I going to figure this out? So number three was protection at foraging sites. And again, now we're looking for near shore and near colony foraging. So the idea for this is that if you can protect the areas around, then you can enable the animals to forage most efficiently. So breeding birds and mammals are central place foragers during the breeding season. They mostly forage within 3 miles of the breeding sites during this time. And so disturbance can cause the animals to leave, reducing feeding and leading to additional energy expenditure. And some of the examples of these guys are guillemots, cormorants, and harbor seals. So again, we would evaluate proposals that benefit the forage or foraging habitat based on the number of animals that are foraging within that area. Gosh. Number four was to evaluate proposals based on how well they protect foraging sites in relation to aggregations at hotspots. So there are oceanographic features that tend to bring prey together, to concentrate prey. Though the prey are highly mobile, they have a greater possibility of being found at these hot spots, and disturbance could impact foraging in this way. And some examples of hot spot predators include marbled murrelets, brown pelicans, gray whales, and harbor porpoises. So again, it's not that they're going to a rookery in per se, but that they're foraging in the ocean in relatively well-defined places. So we would analyze whether proposals, how well they have, they overlap with the hot spots that we've identified. And then finally, protection in bays and estuaries. Obviously, bays and estuaries as well provide critical resting and foraging habitat for thousands of migrant birds. And Humboldt Bay is a critical stopover for many migrant shorebirds as they make their way along the Pacific coast. So threats include loss of habitat, disturbance at foraging areas, and hunting of waterfowl. So again, what we would do would be to evaluate the proposals in relation to the percent of available estuary tidal flats, coastal marshes, and beach habitat, and how well they're protected, and with a particular emphasis on Humboldt Bay. So our conclusions are that this region has regional and global significance for marine mammals and seabirds. It supports most of the state's nesting seabirds, and it has the largest California rookery of threatened stellar sea lions. Marine birds and mammals will receive both direct and indirect benefits from marine protected areas, and many species would benefit from protection while in Humboldt Bay. Several species would also benefit from protection of foraging areas within the state waters defined by those hotspots. So what we've done today, really briefly, is that we propose draft evaluation analysis methods and have provided examples of ways in which these tools can be used when we assess MLPA proposals. I want to talk to you just briefly about possible additions to the evaluations that are different than some of the other areas. We have four long-term year-round unpublished studies on the abundance and distribution of gray whales, harbor seals, stellar sea lions, and seabirds along the coast here, including one that is looking at seabirds and pinnipeds holistically over an entire year. To understand why gray whales are different here, I'll just give you a quick little idea. Gray whale natural history, they're typical mysticetes, and they split their life history up into two parts, where they spend the summer months up in the northern seas, the Bering and Chukchi Sea, feeding, and then typically migrate past the coast, where they go down to the southern lagoons and Baja to breed and give birth. And so in all the other regions in California, you just have two peaks of abundance of gray whales going by. But what's different here is that Northern California is the southern terminus of the Pacific Coast feeding aggregation. And so during the summer months, instead of going all the way up to the Bering and Chukchi Sea, there's a small population of around 300 animals that stays in Northern California, Oregon, Washington, B.C., and Southeast Alaska, and does the majority of their feeding down here. And that southern terminus of that feeding range lies within the North Coast region. So we have a long-term study of gray whales, and these are the study sites along the coast in Oregon and California that's been going for over 10 years now. So this offers an opportunity to look at sort of the generalized pattern of gray whales off the coast, and you see that they are present here during the summer as well as year-round during the typical migration periods when you'd expect them to be here. I want to make one more point here. This enables us to do a sort of hotspot analysis in relation to where and when you'd expect to see gray whales along the coast here, but it's not the same as the oceanographic analysis that Craig and others will be providing. So I think it would be a useful addition. We also have marine mammal data, again, year-round information for both harbor seals and stellar sea lion that's been collected at HSU that's yet to be published. And this is important when we're trying to distinguish between special closures or the different levels of protection, because obviously these animals are dependent upon these rocks in the area for breeding, but they also are here year-round for different purposes, and these long-term data sets are important to be able to inform those decisions. So with that, we'd like to thank you and ask if there's any questions.
Thanks for that presentation. I'm going to jump right in, because I don't have to raise my own tag to ask a question. I had, let me see if I can find it here. Oh, blast. Anybody want to jump in? Where was it? Oh, I know it. Could you speak more about or clarify for me when you had the it was all the way on the front page here. Wasn't that it? Oh, here it is. You're talking about the evaluation for MPA proposals. There were two questions I had. Were you going to include only special closures and SMRs for seabirds? Are these SMRs that eliminate all that disturbance, or are we just SMRs in terms of the take issues? I should probably know this, but I just want to clarify it for.
That would be SMRs that a no-take zone, mm-hmm. which would preclude boats from going in there. I don't think the SMRs preclude boating. This is actually a good point,
right.
Because there are recreational vessels that are not taking vessels, but they would still only benefit seabirds if they were excluded from the area.
Okay.
We'll use kayaking as an example of a no-take recreational vessel, which can impact seabirds. So that's a point that needs clarification.
Okay.
Special closures are specifically designed for no boat traffic for the purpose of eliminating disturbance.
And my second question was, in deciding or proposing to evaluate the whole study region, not bioregions, you mentioned to avoid bias due to disproportionate distribution of rookeries. Could you just talk a little bit more about that? I frankly didn't catch all of it, so I just want to make sure I understand.
Well, the first point in using the whole region is that these species are they're California current species, and they range all the way up and down the coast, so they don't have the same kind of barriers to dispersal that fish or plankton do that we were discussing as in our selection of the bioregions. And then the second point is that because all the largest seabird colonies and marine mammal rookeries are in the north bioregion, we wanted to give the entire region a fair representation, a level playing field in terms of the total population in the whole region. And so we are basically ignoring the bioregion distinction here. That would be the reason that we want to look at the whole region so that we're not biasing, giving a disproportionate weighting to the southern bioregion where actually a lot fewer birds are found. Did Ron want to add to that?
Yeah, just we also discussed having a kind of a site-by-site discussion of what the impacts are rather than trying to make a proportion that would be really not legitimate because of the shifted distribution.
So would the proposal that you're going to do proportion of populations as well as number of rookery sites kind of offset? I mean, one, you have a bias in terms of total distribution of most of the animals are in the north, but there were a whole lot of dots along the coast. So I'm thinking, is proportion of population as well as number of sites going to kind of get both ends of that that question? I mean, you could evaluate either of those independently.
Yeah, we have yet to develop the criteria of proportion of the total population and number of sites, but they're both going to come into play, the number of colonies protected and the proportion of the population for each species likely to benefit.
Will?
I just had a question for clarification. I think you spoke about it, but I was looking at your scorecard for the designations, and fur seal, elephant seal, and harbor seal had a score of 1 for bycatch and discard, and I was wondering, was that fishing gear related, or how did they get that score?
Those are from other from studies in other areas, and they are fisheries related. I'm sorry.
I mean, is there a specific fishery that I'm not? I mean, gillnet's not allowed in state waters.
Right.
I was wondering, is it like a crab trap type fisheries, or what is it, entanglements with this gear? Or?
There have been entanglements with crab traps and with that type of fishing equipment up here. And it's from an historical perspective as well.
Okay.
Yes, I had actually two questions. One, for a few of these evaluation methods for the MPAs, you mentioned, you know, determining whether an MPA protects a rookery or something like that. I was wondering if that's there's a radius involved in that. Is there some minimum area around a particular site that would have to count?
Yeah, that's a good question. There is a radius, and it's generally between 300 and 500 feet, so it's not a really huge radius to avoid having birds and marine mammals flushing. That's a good ballpark. There's also, with the neritic foraging of the central place foragers, there's a few species that forage within 3 miles of their breeding colony, and so that radius would just be a 3 mile radius. So those are two different protection measures. But the 300 to 500 feet is probably what we're looking at for the colonies and rookeries.
Right, yeah, so the 3 miles, and I wanted to make sure that we weren't talking about that for everything. And then the other question, and maybe this is written down somewhere and I just haven't found it, was about the pelagic foraging hotspot analysis and how that was going to work. And maybe it's just, could you just talk a little bit more about that approach? And how are you going to quantify that?
There's two ways to look at it. One is to look at oceanographic patterns to see if we have upwelling or what's the term? Entrainment, where a lot of fish are likely to concentrate. The other thing that's probably going to be more useful is to look at the marine transect data and use where seabirds and marine mammals concentrate as a proxy for a hotspot. And that's what we're really after, is where are these animals concentrating on some level of consistency. Now, hotspot patches shift. However, in the broad average, we're going to get data where we can see that this area consistently has a lot of birds or a lot of gray whales, and so that will be used as informing where hot spots are. And we have actually yet to get those data assimilated, so we'll see how it falls out.
I have one other question, and this is... we had issues with in the South Coast with beach grooming, as far as how far upland the MLPA reaches. And I'm just curious, what's the word on hunting? Because, you know, the MLPA may not deal with it. I'd just like to know whether we want to step into that.
In previous regions, they've used state marine managed recreation areas. So there's a lot of waterfowl hunting areas in this region, and it would default to that designation. You would prohibit all other take but allow the duck hunting.
Any further questions from the SAT? Okay, so this is still open for discussion. We're not adopting any proposals. I think this is a great presentation to kind of lay out, well, everything from who matters and why MPAs may affect them, and how we're going to think about evaluating them. So, if there'll be further development of this by the work group, presumably based on input from questions and things like that, in reaction to questions, and we will work towards adopting the methods for approval at some future, hopefully soon, meeting at the February meeting, or at the very latest at the March one if we can't get it in at the webinar. So, Craig, you had some further reaction.
Just one thing I forgot to include in our presentation is as regards special closures protecting some of these important rookeries or colonies, we talked about the range, 300 to 500 feet. There's also a seasonal component to those closures in that the animals are only breeding for a part of the year, basically, generally from May to August. So special closure enactments would be seasonal or could be seasonal closures. I just wanted to put that out there, not all year round.
Okay, great. I know it hasn't seemed like we've gone very far into this meeting, but we're actually going to take about a 5-minute break here to try to establish the conference line for the folks to be able to listen in and interact as they need to. You may have heard the attempt to dial during the middle of the presentation. We don't want to have that happen again. So if we could come back at about 2:15, that's about 6 minutes by my watch. I'd appreciate that. Thanks. Okay, we're about to start again, so if we could take our seats, folks. Okay, we're going to get started here again. Welcome back. Before we move on to item D, Dawn would like to say a few words more about the potential for evaluations based on gray whales and get some feedback from the SAT on how to proceed.
Thanks, Eric. So we were looking for a little bit of feedback from the SAT here about how to move forward with the gray whale analysis, and given that they are here in the summertime, it seems that that we should incorporate them in some more formal fashion than they've obviously been treated with before. So in talking with Eric a little bit at the break, we were just trying to think about ways that this type of thing might have been done before, and one of the issues is that you, over the last 12 years at any of those given survey sites, you can have huge pulses of gray whales, and then the next year they won't be there, they'd be in another place, but then they'd come back in a subsequent year. And he was thinking about possibly doing sort of yearly average or coastwide average of how likely it would be to be able to see gray whales feeding there during the summer. But I was just wondering if anyone else had any input or feedback about how to include them.
And just as to follow up on that, not necessarily as a full-blown quantitative measure, but more even if it was just as a source of information to folks who are designing MPAs, whether we're going to say you're covering 60% of likely gray whale habitat, maybe not so much an issue as this is an area likely to be used in a number of years to be just to kind of inform the process. I'm not sure what level this analysis would rise to.
Can you give us a sense on the map of the study sites that you showed? Is that a sort of an exhaustive set of where gray whales forage in the area, or is that just where it's possible to get in and actually observe them?
It's a pretty complete set of where they're likely to feed. We've just expanded it a bit south this year, and it seems that around Humboldt Bay they aren't really feeding, but from Trinidad up to the Oregon border and a bit beyond, those are the spots where they're most likely to be feeding. And they feed sort of there consistently, except there are sort of, they sort of move between sites as theoretically they farm out the critters that are there and then come back in subsequent years.
But you don't think there are other sites on here that we just haven't, where we just haven't observed them, but they're there?
No, because we, those are, that's the long-term data from shore sites, but we've also done boat surveys and that for to do photo identification work, and we haven't seen other hotspots. Those seem to be the places where they are.
Is that right? So it strikes me that the interesting thing about the whales is not that they're there, but not that the whales are there, but they're there doing something. And so it's less about, in terms of spatial management, it'd be less about spatial management of a mobile creature, but much more like the pelagic species, where the idea is that you're not protecting the birds, you're protecting the foraging site of the birds. So I wonder if you thought about not paying attention so much to the whales, like abundances, but instead going back and saying, what's different about these places on the bottom versus other places, and using that as a criteria in the analysis.
That's an interesting perspective. We have one study that was looking at the foraging ecology of those animals and then doing invertebrate analysis, both from the front and back end of whales as well as from the bottom of the of the ocean there. And so we have some idea about the relationship between prey distribution and abundance and whale distribution and abundance. But again, as Craig was saying about the hot spots, one way to look at them is you find the critters that are using them, and then that's kind of the relationship that you would assume is the abiotic factors that you're trying to support. Does that make sense?
Go. Yeah, I think we're saying the same thing, except for I wonder if you just basically if you assume that that the whales are using areas that are good, you know, foraging habitat, and then you look. I don't know how good the mapping is, but if the mapping is good enough to essentially look at sort of random sites versus sites used by whales, you could use that as a criteria to say, okay, these are the sorts of benthic habitats that are important to whales, and you know about the probability that they're going to use these sorts of sites, and then it sort of begins to set up criteria that you could think about, essentially, I think like Eric was saying, sort of probabilities that they will occur in a particular kind of habitat.
Okay, I get it now. That makes sense, yeah. The one thing about gray whales is that they are fairly generalist. They feed on sort of epibenthic in fauna as well as pelagic prey, but I think that's a good approach. Thanks.
I just also wanted to throw out there for the SAT to chew upon is the potential analogy between the use by gray whales of this handful of spots up and down the coast. That sort of data, they're there some years, they're not there other years. Some areas, I don't know, maybe preferred, returned to more frequently than others. But the analog is to kelp forests, where we had areas that had kelp 5 or 6 years out of 7 of a survey versus kelp forests that were only detected in 1 or 2 years of a 7-year survey. And so that might be a weighting for some of these areas. Acknowledging the controversy that emerges when you start using various measures of what counts. But whales are not habitat, so maybe it doesn't, unless they die, and we're not worried about that. So.
If you like white sharks.
Speak into the mic, Eric.
we don't want whales to die, but we're not worried about whale fall habitat. Those are temporary. Anyway, that might be something for the SAT to think about.
Thank you.
Are there any other comments on this? We can certainly give feedback to that group through appropriate channels outside of the meeting as well. If there's no other comments, let's move on to item D. We're going to hear a presentation from Dominic. He's going to give us an overview of water quality considerations for MPAs in the North Coast. So, Dominic, go ahead.
Thanks, Eric. Just trying to figure out how to use this for sure. Because you really have to be sensitive. It's very touchy. So my intention today is just to kind of give you an update about what the Water Quality Work Group has been doing. We had a couple of meetings. Much of this presentation was a result of those meetings. The other intention is to give you just some idea, sort of a Water Quality 101 for the North Coast, just to kind of get everybody on the same page with what some of the issues that the working group has been dealing with on this. And I'll start out by just saying that the North Coast has generally very good marine water quality. It's a very large area. It's drained by a large set of watersheds, but it's got a pretty sparse population. And the water quality problems that I am going to focus on in this presentation are mostly very limited spatially. So it's really important to keep that in mind. Just coming off of the South Coast area, it's very different. So here's just an overview of what I'm going to cover. We'll talk a little bit about water quality standards. We're going to talk about water quality opportunities and areas of water quality concern. Some special considerations that I want to discuss briefly with you, and then guidance and evaluation methods. So first, with regard to water quality standards, I'm using one of our water quality control plans, the California Ocean Plan, as an example. It covers near coastal waters out to 3 miles. It's approved by the US EPA, as are all the other water quality control plans. There are three components generally to a water quality control plan. The first two have to do with the standards themselves. There are beneficial uses, and then there are objectives. So the objectives might be narrative or they might be numeric, but they relate to those beneficial uses. So to give you an example, let's say you've got a beach where lots of people go for contact recreation, swimming, surfing, that sort of thing. That would be a beneficial use. So there are some beneficial uses that relate specifically to human health, but there are other beneficial uses that relate more to the quality of the habitat or the environment for marine life. And so just keep that in mind as we go through the presentation. The program of implementation is simply a way that we enforce those standards. And so for the most part, the standards are enforced through permits. And a part of the implementation program has to do with prohibition. So certain things are just not allowed to be discharged. And one of those kinds of prohibitions has to do with areas. And so in the next slide, I'll go through this a bit, but areas of special biological significance were designated in the 1970s. Our general rule on that is waste discharges are prohibited there. So I wanted to mention really briefly, there are other water quality control plans. For example, there's the Enclosed Bays and Estuaries Plan that focuses mostly on sediment quality. There's basin plans. Each regional board has a basin plan. The basin plans cover all discharges into streams, bays, and the ocean wherever one of those other plans does not control. In other words, if there isn't a standard in the ocean plan, but there is one in the basin plan, then that's applicable. And there's a California toxics rule also, which is developed by US EPA that's enforced in bays and estuaries. So getting back to areas of special biological significance, ASBSs, they are what I would consider and what we did in the last study area, we considered them water quality opportunities. So if you co-locate an MPA with a ASBS, you're getting sort of the full package of protection there. You're getting protection depending on the level of MPA, you're getting protection from take if it was a reserve, and you're also getting protection from water pollution. There are four of these in the North Coast study region, And I've got another slide right after this that'll explain where those are. All of them are considered state water quality protection areas under the Marine Managed Areas Improvement Act, which is part of the Public Resources Code. It's the same act that set up the three classification of MPAs as well. Again, waste discharges are prohibited. We did find quite a few discharges when we went out and looked back in 2003, but we're actively working to solve those problems right now. And we also have an ongoing monitoring effort in ASBSs. So just to give you an idea where those water quality opportunity areas are, there are four of them, as I said earlier. There's two small ones, one at Jug Handle Cove, which is south of Fort Bragg, and Trinidad Head is another one of the small ones. The King Range and the Redwood ASBSs are both very large, so you have a lot of area there to work with. So that brings us up to some of the water quality concerns. And the first one I want to talk about is urban stormwater runoff. As I mentioned earlier, there's not a lot of population in the North Coast area. But there are some cities, and so those cities that are above a certain level of population or discharged to a sensitive habitat are covered under what we call our stormwater permit. And I listed those up there as McKinleyville, Arcata, Eureka, Fortuna, and Fort Bragg. And generally, the permits, these are phase two. They're not phase one communities. So a phase one community would be like, you know, San Francisco or Los Angeles, real big cities. These are medium to small size cities, but they still have very specific requirements. And the important thing to remember whenever we call something urban stormwater that has a permit, that means it's technically a point source. So a lot of people will think of those as non-point sources, but they're actually a point source. So that kind of brings us into the other category that's real similar, that are the non-point sources. And there are really four categories that I highlighted here. Urban runoff from an area that's not one of those phase two communities would be included in that. Agricultural runoff, and I kind of use that term agricultural loosely. It could be grazing, it could be dairies, it could be that sort of thing. So I'm kind of lumping animal husbandry in with agriculture. Timber harvest is a big issue in the North Coast area. A lot of the legacy watershed impairments have to do with previous timber harvesting activities. And then marinas and harbors. And there's no real distinction between those, marinas for small craft and then harbors for bigger vessels. But they have similar problems associated with them. And so there are some areas of concern that this is simply just sort of a proposal at this point. We're still working on this. But some of the locations that we thought we would mention today, Smith River mouth, Crescent City and the harbor at Crescent City, the Klamath River, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later, Trinidad and the Trinidad Harbor area, the Mad River, Arcata and Humboldt Bays, the Eel River, Shelter Cove and the little harbor. I don't want to really call it a true harbor, but it's more like a launch ramp and a breakwater, and the Fort Bragg, Noyo Bay, harbor activities there. I mention these with a little bit of trepidation because I don't want to frighten stakeholders from completely avoiding all these areas. It's important to remember that the water quality guidance is there to help you, and if you can avoid an area, it would be great. But especially with some of the estuaries, you might not be able to avoid it. And just keep that in mind that the main SAT guidance with regard to size and spacing and habitat replication, those are the primary things you need to be concerned with. But if you can avoid water quality problems and if you can co-locate with ASBSs, it would be great. So just keep that in mind because, you know, there's kind of a large list of estuaries there, and I don't want to frighten you away from all of those. And also for Humboldt Bay, it's a very large estuary, And you know, obviously not all of the bay is impacted, so keep that in mind. So getting to the traditional point sources, the wastewater discharges, we just provided lists here. There's a few that I'm going to highlight. The Samoa Island pulp mill, and it's also got a small power plant that is co-located with it. That is the only one of the discharges in the North Coast that we considered major. Now, that term major is different for EPA purposes than for the MLPA SAT purposes. Down in Southern California, we made a decision to take what EPA would consider major and break them into major and intermediate. So that's the classification that you have there on the slide. But a pulp mill is problematic for water quality. They have the tendency to discharge dioxins, which is among the most toxic chemicals that you could discharge. The current status of that pulp mill is that it's not in operation now, but they want to start discharging again, and they've submitted a request to the Regional Water Board to start discharging again. I think sometime in the summer is their target date. And so that's not exactly the kind of place you'd want to put an MPA, is right on top of that outfall. And so I wanted to kind of focus on that. There's a bunch of cities there in the intermediate category. And what I'm not going to talk about each thing, but one thing I do want to mention is, and I don't want to just pick on Fortuna, because there's a whole bunch of communities on the Eel River. And during the wet season, they all discharge into the Eel River. And, of course, they get a lot of dilution because of all the rainfall and runoff, but that is something to keep in mind, that the Eel River does have a lot of point source discharges on it. Then there's minor discharges. Generally, these are those that are less than a million gallons a day. And there's a couple that I want to focus on. The Pacific Gas and Electric Company has a power plant here in the Eureka area. And that was a nuclear plant at one time. Then it converted to fossil fuel combustion for its energy source. And during that time period, and I think even up to right now, it's using a process called once-through cooling that causes impingement of fish and entrainment of plankton, notably ichthyoplankton. And that's a really big deal. And in Southern California, that was a huge deal. We thought that that was the most damaging of all of the water quality types of impacts. But the good news, and the reason why it's a minor discharge here, is they're converting to closed cycle cooling. And they're only going to have a discharge less than a million gallons a day. Sometime within a few months, that's going to be affected. In other words, they've got all their equipment in place. They're just in the process of switching over now, but all the major construction's been done. So I talked to the regional board, and it's going to be just weeks or months before that converts. So for our purposes here, it's better to consider that a minor discharge at this point. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is Shelter Cove. So I mentioned that ASBSs are protected from waste discharges. There is a process where a plant can get an exception, but then it has very strict conditions applied to it. And the Shelter Cove treatment plant has one of those exceptions. It's a relatively small plant anyway. There is a fish cleaning station at Shelter Cove that we're working with the discharger on now to alleviate that problem. But again, these are the minor discharges. So some special considerations. You might have heard of the term 303D listed. That refers to a section of the Clean Water Act. The state has to report those water bodies that don't meet the standards that I referred to earlier to the US EPA. And there are some of those in the North Coast. So sort of a big picture thing I want to mention. If you saw the map of the 303D listed water bodies in the North Coast, you would gasp. The whole map looks red, you know, red being where the 303D listings are. But there's a reason for that. It's not that there's huge amounts of industrial pollution there. Mostly those are for things like temperature influences and sediment influences in the stream. And I'm not minimizing those kinds of problems, but those are in-stream issues as opposed to the issues that you would be concerned about. And so keep that in mind that, again, the North Coast, the marine waters are generally very good water quality. But there are some issues. Humboldt Bay is one where it is listed for sediment pollution. And the two specific chemicals are dioxins and PCBs. And you can see there in this map, you could probably look at it better if you downloaded the presentation. But there are three lines of evidence that we use in the Enclosed Bays and Estuaries Plan. It's the benthic condition. In other words, what is the marine life doing there? The chemistry of the sediment and the toxicity of the sediment. And you can see most of the problems there are associated in the north part of the bay. Other special considerations. I mentioned beach bacteria. There's a couple in this area that I know of that are listed for that, Trinidad and Moonstone. Those are associated with human health risks. But just remember, if there's high bacteria there, that doesn't mean that there aren't other pollutants. It just means that those are the ones that we know about there. So that's just something to keep in mind. The major thing there in that first bullet that I want to talk about is the Klamath River. Klamath River has dams on it. Those dams, I think, by 2020 are scheduled to be demolished. And so those dams currently act like incubators for blue-green algae, which is very, very, very toxic. And in fact, the Klamath River is listed for toxicity from those biotoxins. So it's a harmful algal bloom. It's primarily a freshwater issue. But in that photo, it's hard to see because of the resolution there, but there's a big green patch in the middle of the estuary just as it's coming out towards the ocean. That's blue-green algae making it all the way down to the mouth. And so that's toxic stuff. It does have effect on wildlife. In the Central Coast, we have mortality associated with eating benthic invertebrates from sea otters eating benthic invertebrates. So there can be effects on wildlife from that. A couple other things I wanted to mention briefly. Coastal energy development, wind and wave energy. These are projects that are actively being planned now. We're looking into it. For right now, our tentative idea is that because they're in the planning stage, they won't be included in the evaluation. But in the guidance document, we'll try to provide more information on that. And then aquaculture is another thing that we've talked about. There are some habitat and water quality and sediment quality aspects of it. And I use the water quality aspect kind of loosely. It's mostly sediment issues. And we'll include that in the guidance document as well. But we think in terms of an evaluation that that's better handled through the levels of protection work group. So in terms of the guidance, We're coming up with an initial proposal for SAT recommendations, and we tried to capture it here. It's something that I've already mentioned, co-locating where possible with the state water quality protection areas, a.k.a. ASBSs. That was a pretty neat set of alphabet soups there, wasn't it? And avoiding, where possible, areas of water quality concern. So that includes urban stormwater, non-point sources, and wastewater point sources. And you can see there, we used the same buffer areas that we used in Southern California, half a mile radius for major sources, quarter mile radius for intermediate sources. And we're suggesting for minor sources just to avoid those points if you can. In the South Coast area, we ended up categorizing the proposals for MPAs for two different kinds of areas, for bays and estuaries, treating them separate from the coastal MPAs. bays and estuaries are more likely to be associated with stormwater runoff, non-point source issues, and even some point sources up here in the North Coast. And there are no ASBSs in bays and estuaries, so it kind of puts them on a different footing. The coastal MPAs, when I say coastal, I'm really referring to the open coast and the islands and rocks. Large areas of ASBS in the North Coast, so there's a lot of those opportunities. So we have had very minor proposed changes to the methods. In general, we suggest that the methods from the South Coast be used here with these minor changes. In the South Coast, we used a measure of the shoreline length divided by two for the bays and estuaries. In the North Coast, we're recommending that we use an area measurement just because the North Coast estuaries are much more natural. South Coast, they were pretty much polygon-shaped. Here, they're very, sinuous, I would say, and there's a lot of distributaries in them. And so it's better to do them by an area basis, and that's what we're recommending at this point. The power plant entrainment is not an issue here, so there's no need to focus on that. And in the South Coast, we had a strong recommendation to avoid the big industrial harbors like L.A., Long Beach, San Diego. Here we're considering just the harbors as non-point sources, so not as bad of a problem as what you would have in the bigger industrial harbors, but they should be taken into account someplace. So the scoring, like in Southern California, we're recommending basing it on presence-absence. Again, co-location with areas of water quality concern, the scores would be deducted. And we categorize stormwater and non-point source pollution as being worse than the wastewater discharges, the traditional point sources. And the reason for that is because the wastewater discharges from an MPDS permit, they're generally better controlled. Non-point sources and urban stormwater does not have as much control associated with it. And we know that urban stormwater is very toxic. And then again, co-location with ASBSs would get a score as well, would improve the score. So if you look at the different ranges, and I'll go through this quickly. So the least desirable score is obviously a zero, and the most desirable is a one. And you would only get a score of one if you were in a coastal ASBS or a coastal MPA that has co-location with an ASBS. That would be the best possible score. But it's unfair to compare the estuaries to the coastal areas. So the best score for an estuary would be a 0.75, and we compare them separately. And this next two slides just show that you get deducted if you're at a stormwater discharge or a wastewater discharge, and the deduction is greater for a stormwater because it's more toxic. And that same thing holds true for the coastal MPAs. It's just that the big difference there is ASBSs are opportunities that those coastal MPAs would have for co-location. And so these are just a couple of examples of how we did this in the South Coast. These are comparisons of whole proposals. And the light blue are the bays, and the dark blue are the coastal MPAs that were proposed. And then this would be an example of a single proposal, and in this case just for coastal MPAs. And those little symbols are there to denote what the water quality problem was for that particular MPA, why it was marked down. And so the red squares were stormwater discharges, and the black triangles were wastewater discharges. And so finally, the next steps, we're going to continue to work on a guidance document for the North Coast Study Region, and that would include maps to show these areas. And then we are hoping to get potential SAT approval of the evaluation process and those maps. So with that, I can answer any questions.
Thanks very much, Dominic. Just to clarify, we're not going to be taking any decision to approve anything today, but certainly any discussion would be very appropriate right now to help Dominic's group figure out where to go. Kevin, please.
I guess I still have a bit of a problem with the scoring, given the secondary nature of it, and it's based upon this. In the South Coast, a number of proposed MPAs were reduced in size because they were trying to avoid a water quality outfall, which might have been a minor impact. So, you know, the guidance to make sure that is secondary, because it's obvious that the larger MPA would have had a more benefit, and that by, you know, shrinking the MPA just so it's outside that border doesn't really affect the MPA any differently than it had it been bigger. So I'm trying to figure out how to get that into the evaluation so that it's not misleading for folks who are trying to draw MPAs the benefit of a larger rather than trying to avoid each of those little individuals, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
No, it does. I think there's two things that we have to do. One, we have to be very clear and keep saying that it is a secondary type of evaluation. The size and spacing and habitat, those are the primary things that they should be thinking about. The other thing to keep in mind, and it's really more of a policy issue, I think, but it does creep in here, and that is that it's really more relative to reserves than conservation areas. Reserves aren't allowed any take, and in any even a well-controlled wastewater treatment system will have some toxicity occasionally if it exceeds its limits, or even just from the discharge itself, it can kill things. But it's in a very, very small area that would take place. And so no matter how you how well you explain that and ask people to avoid those where possible, that take is going to happen if a reserve is co-located. And so it's not as much of a problem with a conservation area or even a park, but a reserve, it's a, you know, kind of steps up the importance a bit.
Yeah, this is probably a real minor issue, but maybe not. I don't know. Your map of Humboldt Bay that shows the sediment pollution is very different from what I've seen before on this subject, and that is that it's my understanding that the channels, you know, from Woodley Island, which is that little island at the northern part, down towards the mouth, is where most of the sediment pollution is. And I'm just wondering if that's something that will be incorporated later on, or if this map is showing something that's different from what I know. Or
no, that's a really good point. So there have been different studies done in Humboldt Bay, and those listings were based on those original studies that you're referring to. The Enclosed Bays and Estuaries standards that the State Water Board just adopted and EPA just approved this last year have a different approach. And so we're trying to rectify that now, those old studies with new studies that were done by EPA. And these this map of Humboldt Bay has the new study information in it with three lines of evidence. And so a lot of the old studies had to do with a single line of evidence, just chemistry, but not necessarily benthic toxicity or benthic community assessment. And so the map that we showed here was just for where we had the three lines of evidence. So we didn't show every possible study result here. It was just for the studies that were done with the three lines of evidence.
Okay. The interesting thing to me was that when there was the last time around, or maybe the time before, I can't remember, when there was a proposal to dredge, you know, the Humboldt mm-hmm. Bay, all of those things showed up in the sediment. And that was a very big issue for the dredge proposal. And I think that it's my understanding that the levels of those the dioxins and PCBs were much higher in the channels where they were getting fresh sediments even, which I think is very different than some other places where the sediments have been around for a long time. You know, they dredge the harbor, the channels regularly, and they get some, you know, stuff. So,
yeah, I think the dioxins are fairly ubiquitous, but at very low levels throughout the bay. And then if you start digging in, you might get into some other areas that are maybe higher concentrations. So these were just surficial sediments that were in this study. So again, this study was done as a standalone study, and it was relative to the new standards. But that doesn't diminish the fact that there are other studies and other dioxin levels at other locations in the bay.
So those other studies can all be integrated into this kind of data set?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think that you know, the issue is just fairly straightforward. There's dioxin and PCB pollution in Humboldt Bay, and we just need to know that.
Let's go to Phil, and then we'll go to Dave.
So excuse my ignorance, but it just occurs to me that in thinking about water quality issues, that the footprint of the water quality issue is larger than where one, say, would go out and measure, you know, sediment toxicity or whatever. It really seems to me to be how that, let's say, persistent organic pollutant is propagated into the food web and then extends out, so that you would have essentially sort of a diffusive component to it that would there wouldn't be a line, it'd be sort of this gradation. Mm-hmm. And that would vary depending on what sort of toxins that you would consider, you know, how things would, you know, do they go through the benthic food web or do they hop right up into forage fish and expand that way? I'm just sort of curious about that, and if you've thought about that, and is it at all relevant to this, or is it too esoteric?
Well, we did think about that in the South Coast. We haven't talked about it at the last two work group meetings up here. But I think that and if I use the South Coast as an example, DDT is ubiquitous down there. So we just had to decide where was the highest concentrations and just focus on that. I think that in this region, so you have that Samoa pulp mill, if that starts operating again, and you've got Humboldt Bay, and you know that there are dioxins there, you probably need to be careful about where you put an MPA. But I think that if you – and we've done this in other places. I mean, in Muscle Watch, we find persistent organic pollutants in mussels pretty far away from impact. So we know that these chemicals get out and disperse. But, you know, if you did that – if you were saying avoid that at all costs – you wouldn't have any MPAs anywhere in California, so you have to be pragmatic about it, I think.
If you have further thoughts on that, you can certainly feed them into that group. Dave, please.
Yeah, Dominic, I wondered, is it possible for you to pull up the next to last slide? Like, can we have the presentation again? Oops. Oh, I'm sorry. All right, one more previous. One before that. Okay, that's the one. I was very interested in your idea that it would be advantageous to co-locate an MPA with a ASBS area, and that kind of resonated with some of our local thoughts about how Redwood National Park might be a very nice place to locate an MPA because of the contiguous you know, preservation of the terrestrial landscape through the intertidal, you know, out offshore. It has a lot of appeal, but I can't reconcile that with the scoring that you have up here, because it looks as if the co-location with an ASBS actually scores lower than the one you have all the way up in the upper right-hand corner. So I just wondered if you could walk us through the logic of these scores, because it doesn't jive kind of with the thoughts. I haven't seen this before. That's just my initial reaction.
Yeah, so the idea was that you get sort of extra points for being associated with an ASBS. And there's actually a third table that it's not shown in the presentation here, but that we used down in the South Coast, and it was sort of a cumulative table. And so what happens for each of the MPAs is that they're averaged. And so if you average all of the water quality concerns and the water quality opportunities, and if you get a zero because you're not located in an ASBS, you would end up with down in the South Coast, you would end up with a 0.75 because there were three water quality concerns there. We might have to adjust that. Makes me think now that we might need to adjust our cumulative table. But if you were located with an ASBS, you would get extra points. So if you remember back to another slide that I mentioned that if you're in a bay, the best score you get is a 0.75. If you're on the open coastal and you're not in an ASBS, you would also get that 0.75, which is still a very good score. But you would get up to a 1 if you completely co-located with an ASBS, and it's based on, you see that one kind of bottom middle box there, based on the percent shoreline coverage. So the reason why we did that in the South Coast is because we didn't want people just to say, oh, we'll put, you know, maybe a few feet of our MPA into an ASBS, and, you know, but we're not going to really make an effort to co-locate. So we wanted more area associated, or in this case, shoreline length with the ASBS to get a better score. So it works out. So if you're completely co-located in ASBS and you avoided all the other water quality problems, which was usually what happened because you're not allowed to have these big discharges in an ASBS, you know, you would get a 1 on an open coastal example. It's kind of hard to explain here. I could show you this, Dave. This is sort of the cumulative table, but
yeah, I think we'd have to wait till later on to see an actual numerical illustration of it, because I kind of am seeing what you're saying, but the table doesn't really convey the thought that you were projecting in the talk, I think.
Yeah, Dominic, I think it would be useful to have like a worked example or a set of worked examples. We had that, I think, for the South Coast to kind of help folks wrap their head around it. So
yeah.
You may not have a North Coast example to do, but something like that would probably be useful.
I completely agree. We just hadn't done that yet. So,
any other questions, comments from SAT members here? Can anybody on the conference call that wants to weigh in call from above? I don't even know if they can hear us, but I just want to give them that opportunity. If they're even listening, yeah.
Yes, we're still listening.
Okay, great. That was Ron. Ron said that, not me. Okay, so we are now at 3:15, and I'm going to make a quick announcement. Our next item E, as I mentioned at the top of the meeting, has been wrapped into item K tomorrow. I've also been asked for those in the public who are interested in finding and reviewing the various briefing documents. The two documents listed under item E have actually been redesignated as documents O1 and O2. They will be introduced in the final item of the agenda tomorrow. They are simply there for information. They're not going to be discussed. We'll be discussing them at a future meeting. I just wanted to make that clarification. Since I'm looking straight across the aisle through Dominic at a tray of cookies, I'm going to say we're going to take our break, which was scheduled for 3-something. We're going to do that now, a very short break. This one I'm actually going to hold you to the 10 minutes. We're at 3:15 roughly right now, so 3:25. We will reconvene, and we will hear from Becky on item F. All right, thank you. Okay, welcome back. We are going to hear now from Becky Oda. She's going to give us an An update. Well, I'll let Becky introduce what the title of this is.
Sure. Thanks, Eric. On behalf of the tribal SAT work group, On behalf of the SAT tribal work group, I'm going to give an update with regards to their meeting. And the tribal work group, in case you need refreshing, is made up of Kevin Fleming, Dr. David Hankin, Dr. Stephen Morgan, Dr. Karina Nielsen, and Dr. Astrid Schultz. The work group met on January 12th, and they discussed key tasks for the group. I just want to run down those just briefly for you and some of the discussions that they had during their work group meeting on the 12th. One of those is important key question are protocols for data submissions by the tribes. The SAT Tribal Work Group will be developing protocols for submitting data on tribal uses. And by the way, SAT Work Group members, if I get something wrong, please jump in and correct me. The protocols will describe the parameters of the data that's needed for MPA planning and evaluation and the timeline of the North Coast Study Region MLPA process to inform the tribes on that. They also suggested that the following parameters would be desirable for information that may be considered for MPA planning and evaluation, and those include the species or species group taken by the tribes, the method of take, the location of take, the magnitude or intensity of take, and when the take occurs, such as seasonality of those species. The SAT work group will also suggested that it would be important to distinguish between subsistence and ceremonial uses for the tribes. The next key element was levels of protection and tribal uses. And the SAT, as we all know, assigns levels of protection for all species taken for commercial recreation or ceremonial cultural purposes. And to assign an LOP to a particular type of take proposed in an MPA, the SAT must consider the species taken, the specific gear type used, and depth range of take if applicable. Information about the magnitude or intensity of take and seasonality also may be useful to determine the potential ecological impacts of allowed take in proposed MPAs. That's just a general rule of LOPs. If any species or methods of take used by Native American tribes are not yet on the list of SAT-approved LOPs, they may be submitted to the SAT for review by tribal members, by others who have the knowledge of that. Another key element was the consideration of the question, and this was brought up, I believe, at the first SAT meeting back in October, will Aboriginal take be considered as part of the ecosystem? The SAT Tribal Work Group and initiative staff definitely acknowledge that this is an interesting and relevant question. It is philosophical in nature to some respects, and and the response depends on other values and the values of the person or the individual responding to the question. But assessing this type of question is beyond this potential beyond the scope of the SAT deliberations for the MLPA initiative process, and clearly includes social values and policy components. However, if the question were focused on scientific investigation with respects to Aboriginal activities as a part of the ecosystem, the level of take by Aboriginal people for an extended period of time, the SAT would need to know the following, but maybe not limited to the species taken, where the take occurs or has occurred, what methods are used or were used, the magnitude of the intensity of take, the seasonality of take, and other relevant information for both the present time and for an extended period of time into the past. The particular time interval is not defined in the question and could span, as we all know, hundreds or thousands of years of activities by the tribes and the ceremonial take or traditional take. Without a detailed anthropological investigation of the historical uses, methods, and intensity, the SAT would not be able to determine whether or not the current range of species taken and methods of take are consistent with historical uses. The tribal work group will continue to work on these issues with the tribes and as they arise, and will be connecting with tribal representatives very soon to address some of these issues. So it's a very important question, the Aboriginal activities with respect to the ecosystem is something that should is something that we'll need to be continuing to look at. It's an adaptive process, as we all know. So if the question can't be answered now, continuing to work on it into the future would certainly be something that would need to be done. That's basically a very quick update on that tribal work group. So if any of the work group members have anything else to add, that would be great.
Anything to add from the members of that work group? Any questions from other members of the SAT? I did have one question. The question always arises is, are we going to get guidance on how to proceed with this? I mean, right now it still remains that what you've reported on seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, remains a component of the SAT, kind of trying to feel our way around what is a very important and potentially sensitive subject. And I know I, for one, would like to have some firmer guidance or grounding. I have no problems like kind of addressing a scientific question, but knowing where it's going to fit in would be comforting.
I think if I might, Chairman Eric, as we had similar things in Southern California dealing with Department of Defense issues that were very unique, and we started by trying to get the legal framework of what was precedent, where we thought we should operate, and also honoring, in this case, the culture, their operations, their sovereignty, and trying to establish just what our bounds really are, and so the task force has asked me to work with legal counsel to come up with some, much as we did in Department of Defense, to kind of what are our policy parameters that we're really operating in, and on the basis of that would possibly give guidance to the science team, saying we're doing some outreach tonight, for example. We've invited tribes to talk about what these are, and as in the past, there have been issues of not wanting to disclose information because it's confidential information. In a past region, we had our tribal representatives basically say, we'll take a look at the maps and we'll tell you whether there's a problem. But otherwise, we're not going to put forward information that we think is not appropriate or is confidential and sacred. So we want to respect that, but we also want to get the legal parameters and then be able to keep you within the science area of what we're going to do over this next year, and there may be some need for some policy calls from the task force to say, yes, we'd like you to look at this, or no, we don't think that's really within our scope or our ability financially to talk about 10,000-year anthropological studies. So that's where we're moving forward, and we're trying to we had a tribal council, as I said, at the Blue Ribbon Task Force meeting last week to talk about the issues that are of concern and how we deal with that. That was one of the things mentioned, its sensitivity of disclosure. And so, and yet, for you to analyze anything, you have to have what it is that you're being asked to analyze. So we're trying to find that sweet spot and define it both legally and respectfully towards the tribes. So we will continue to do that and keep you posted.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I think everyone on the work group was sensitive to this problem, as you've put it, and we were trying to anticipate, well, what are the likely things we might be asked to ask to answer scientifically, and what kinds of information would we need to do that? And this was our attempt to say, these are the kinds of bits and pieces of information that could be useful, and it's sort of a work in progress, and we're going to keep going so that we don't get blindsided at the last minute where we get a legal judgment and then we don't have anything in hand to do anything with it. So I think that's the spirit of the way we're trying to move forward.
Anything else?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, just to add to that and what Ken has said, the Department of Fish and Game and the Directorate's office continues to reach out to the tribes and discuss these issues with them with regards to legality and policy and rights. So it is a complex issue that we're continuing to work on and meeting with the tribes and talking this through. So.
And to that issue, I might add that I think Deputy Director Mastrop has been up many times and at this week's meeting reiterated his willingness to meet with any of the tribal councils, which is an issue of the sovereignty issue and the government-to-government issue and how you deal, which is beyond our process. It's an issue that has been here for a long time, will continue to be. But this is an opportunity from our process and for the department to be available, and he's made himself available. I think has some meeting schedules, has been up here at three or four of these tribal meetings to help and support us as we move through it. So it's every agency. Kevin, of course, is with Parks, has their process and needs of dealing with tribal interests. Department of Water does. The agency does. Fish and Game has its unique way and history. And I think Director Mastrop has said, you know, it's something we need to do better, and the MLPA offers the platform to do it, but it's not necessarily all part of the MLPA process, but it may be informative and an opportunity to improve.
Well, thanks for that. Karina, your point, and if I had missed what you saying that, Becky, I apologize, but that would help clarify it for me. Bill?
Yeah, just another clarifying question. So will we get for any MPA scenario, we'll get the economic, you know, here's the biological, say, costs and benefits of a particular scenario. Here are the economic, you know, costs, right? Is there also something that would give us the social, cultural costs and benefits of scenarios as well? So in other words, the non-economic social side of things?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but we have no formal evaluation of that other than unless it's one of the other MLPA goals that I haven't seen evaluations for. I know there is a, you know, kind of a use education kind of thing.
Right, and we don't do a cost-benefit analysis in the traditional sense of either straight economic or the cultural of loss or benefit. We, through EcoTrust, we have done a potential worst case economic loss, yeah. And that's their 100-penny approach, and that, you know, that they have developed, and those maps and the actually dealing with some of the same confidentiality issues with commercial and recreational interests that we would deal with the tribe similarly, but trying to just make sure we have a form to get that information so there's a choice to say you have an opportunity to avoid economic impact by, as we did just in the region here below us, by moving the line a mile and a half, significantly less impact and because of how people had anonymously registered in for potential impact. And we may be able to use some of that same methodology here as we try to avoid sacred and cultural sites for the tribes. But that's, as Karina said, we're kind of feeling our way through that, how we do that, but we want to get it set up, meet with the tribes to understand how we can have that kind of dialogue to make sure it informs our process.
Anything else from the SAT or from our voices on the conference line? Okay, then we'll move on to item G. Is there a presentation associated with this in any way, Seth? Okay, so if we could get...
It's G2.
G2 queued up. We're going to get an update on the species likely to benefit from MPAs from the North Coast Study Region. We discussed this at some length at the last meeting, and what we'd like to do here is have an update of that that list, and we'll be looking to approve this material at the webinar when we have a more complete representation in the SAT.
Thanks, Eric. So they're going to bring up G2 in a second with it, which is a draft list that you can see there. But the other document associated with this agenda item is G1, which is the criteria document that you all saw at your last meeting, and that is attached, as I said, as document G1. And aside from one typo that was corrected, it's exactly the same as it was at the last meeting because there were no changes that were asked to be made to that document. As Eric said, we'll be looking to take a vote on both that criteria document and the draft species likely to benefit list that you can see up on the screen on the February 11th webinar. So the real update of this is please look at these two documents, email me any comments you have, and be prepared to discuss and potentially vote on them at the February 11th meeting. If you'll take a look up at the screen, you can see the just couple changes that we made to the actual list layout. You can see there on the – we added a column here that's called species likely to benefit, and it has a yes or a no. And this is because we were asked to include all of the species that had been evaluated at one time or another for inclusion on the list. And that then includes species that were evaluated but then did not actually make the list. So if I use the – yay. So if you scroll down here, let me find some. So down here, you can see here that Dungeness crab didn't actually make the list, but we evaluated it. So it gets a no and the species likely to benefit. And you can see that its total score is a 1. And remember, to make the list, it had to score in one of these two filtering criteria here and in one of these two filtering criteria. And you see it did not score in for filter 2, which is feature association or limited adult home range. So it gets a no. So it did not make the list, but it was evaluated for the list. You can also see that there are a lot of blanks on this list, and those are areas where we haven't yet had time or information to evaluate them. So this is what I'd really like you all to take a look at, is this draft list. Go ahead, look at those blanks. Look at the things that aren't blanks, too, in your areas of expertise, and send me comments before the next meeting so we can get this list as complete as possible. The thing to remember, though, too, is that this list is a living document, and so if the edits don't come in by next meeting, we can approve it as a draft potentially, and then other edits I'm sure will come along throughout the process. In the North Central Coast, actually, one of the very last action items was a change to the species likely to benefit list, or an addition. So take a look, email changes to me, and be prepared to discuss at the next meeting.
Any immediate questions from the SAT on this? Okay, so this puts us in the unusual position of having completed. Oh, I'm sorry, Phil.
I'm sorry. I keep having questions. This is why I don't show up.
You're also in the seat that Craig had last time, and I never saw him. I must have no peripheral vision out of my left eye.
So just a. For me to understand this list better, so if something's not on here, you want to know that, right? I mean, it's
yes.
Not just filling in the blanks, but
okay. Yeah, if there are additional species that you think should be on this list, by all means, send them my way.
Okay, and regarding the criteria, to what extent are these criteria done?
They have not yet been fully approved by the SAT, but at the last meeting there was extensive discussion about them, and they were sort of – the work group was told to go ahead with the criteria as appropriate.
Okay.
But if you have comments on them, by all means.
Well, the one comment I have is just about adult home range, and I'm just curious how you dealt with the situation with a lot of rockfish where you, and would be true for lane cod too. Where you have extremely small home ranges, so they would score very high, right, as likely to benefit. But they also have extremely high variance among individuals and even within individuals in their home range. So you have like lingcod will sit around, they'll sit on a rock, you know, for months and then suddenly disappear and show up miles and miles away. So the average size of the home range is probably meaningless. You know what I mean? In terms of how they're likely to benefit. It's really more about the distribution of moves and how, you know, the probability that they're going to make a big move, not that average size. So, but I don't know how you deal with it in this context.
We don't have any sort of specific numeric threshold for home range. It's more expert opinion, Larry Allen, for example, for the fish. And it's just sort of the cumulative, does this species as an adult, is this species likely to stay in an area for a significant amount of time that is smaller than a potential proposed MPA? And so for a lot of these species, like rockfish, yes, that the answer is yes for a lot of those species, is that they will stay within an area that's smaller than the size of an average MPA for a very long time. It might not be their entire lives, and there will definitely be some individuals that are crazy and are zooming all over the place. But it's just sort of the species taken as a whole. Does that make sense?
I think Phil, your point is well taken. There's also the issue, I mean, if a lingcod's going to sit there for a substantial amount of time and it gets some protection, this does not necessarily have to be complete protection. It can be, you know, something that settles into an MPA is going to get a bonus to its survival for, you know, some number of years or months or something like that. Do you have anything to add to this at this point, Will? Because you're the one who thinks about this a lot. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but... yeah, you know, you've looked at these data.
The point Phil raises is exactly right, that we just don't know what happens with some of these things. There are these awful distributions, and the way we deal with it for the models is that we don't use the average. We use something more like the median or some other percentile of what's been measured, and that seems to capture more what the typical individual would do without having these really long tail distributions that throw things off. So, this would be sort of more consistent with the way the models work.
Okay, I'm struggling through this thing, but one question, I guess, just is how the various criteria here are applied is a, for example, thing, feature association. I see for most birds that I'm familiar with, that's checked with a one, and certainly for seabirds, it's islands or a distinct feature association. I question it in the context of all the waterfowl for birds, which is estuarine, open water habitat, but then there's no feature association for all the rockfish, which is rocky bottom habitat. It just seems like this thing is getting applied differently to different groups. And then my other comment, totally different, is that I think I see some fish species that occurred in the South Coast and maybe just stayed on the list, which aren't up here. And so not only might we want to add species, if warranted, we might want to drop some as well, like white sea bass and giant sea bass. And there's probably others. I'm not a total fish person, but... we might want to look to delete some species so that we sound like we really know what we're doing.
Larry has already sent an email saying to delete those two species, so good eye. And to your first point, you're exactly right. The criteria are applied differently to the different taxonomic groups, and that's where the criteria document comes in. There's a paragraph for each taxonomic group in that criteria document describing how the different criteria were applied. And for rockfish, for example, in the South Coast Feature Association, we started off just putting anything that was associated with a rocky reef or a kelp forest as yes, it has feature association for the fishes, but that turned out to be just about every single fish. So we decided to be a little more discerning in what we describe a feature, because you can kind of say that everything has some sort of feature association, be it an open sandy bottom or a rocky reef or a kelp forest or something. So the criteria document really takes care of how we applied the criteria differently to different taxonomic groups.
Any other questions, thoughts? Okay, so we, as Seth has asked, members of the SAT, obviously members of the public as well, can provide input through various channels to this list, try to get it nailed down, remove the offending species, things like that. Make sure that we have all of the ones that are of relevance to the North Coast, and that filled with your question of what to add, we have the boundaries of the study region to consider. I mean, that's pretty obvious. And we'll look to approve this if the SAT deems it worthy of approval at the next meeting. Any other comments on this? Okay. Now, we're still in the unusual position of having reached the end of the day's agenda rather early, and so we're going to take good advantage of that and adjourn. Tomorrow, however, we have an exceedingly full day. We're going to have a couple of presentations, more likely than not, being provided by substitutes or by remotely from folks that could not get here due to travel, weather-related travel issues, et cetera. So we'll see you all again tomorrow at 8:30, ready to rock and roll, and hopefully we'll get off to a good start and get through the day tomorrow. Thanks again, and we'll see you tomorrow. Is there anything that needs to be added? Okay. All right. We are in – oh, Craig.
This is another little thing of clarification that I noticed between Stephen Rumrill's Habitats talk last meeting and Dominique's. This is North Coast Study Region. How many miles of coastline are there? Stephen had 540. Dominique had 640. We just need clarification on, is that a typo, or are we using different boundary maps or what? So just one of those things.
No, I was thinking the same thing when we were putting the presentation together, so I agree. I think part of it might have to do with, is it coastal miles, or does it include the shorelines of all the bays? But I agree, we need to. Yeah.
Well, let's get someone who's a habitat map expert to give us all the right number, and we'll work with that. All right, I think that truly brings us to the end. All right, goodbye. Everyone get out of here. Okay. We'll see you all tomorrow. Thanks.